This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. California has long been out front, or near it, on employment law trends, and that certainly holds true this year. New compliance requirements involving the minimum wage, parental leave, job interviews, and sexual harassment have taken effect. And as is often true in the Golden State, more could be on the way. Fortunately, we may have the perfect guest with us to dissect all of these developments. Bruce Sarche is a management side employment attorney with the Sacramento office of Littler Mendelson. Bruce is also a member of Littler's Workplace Policy Institute, where he focuses on California state legislative and regulatory changes. He speaks frequently on these issues, and we're pleased to have him with us. Bruce, welcome.
Oh, thank you, David. It's a great pleasure to be with you again.
Well, it's great to have you back. And Bruce, of all the new laws in California affecting employers, does one really stand out to you above the others?
There's a lot to choose from this year, that's for sure, David. The legislature was active in 2017, and Governor Brown signed more of these employment-related bills than he has in past years. 2018, by the way, is his last year as governor, and in 2019 we'll have a new governor here in the Golden State. But standing out from the pack this year, I think, are the laws relating to the application and hiring process. Two of them, the pay history inquiry ban and California's version of ban the box. In a nutshell, as part of our continuing evolution of our equal pay law here in California, which now, by the way, is really called a fair pay law, the sort of thinking was that past pay inequities would be perpetuated if employers were able to base their pay offer to a job applicant on what the applicant previously made. So in California, effective January 1st, you have to take a look at your job application form and your job interview processes and scrub out of there completely the question, well, what are you making now? Or what's your pay history been? What have you made in the past? Those questions are no longer permitted in California. And then our version of ban the box requires that before you undergo a criminal background check of a job applicant, that you make a conditional offer of employment to them and say, yeah, you can come work here, but you've got to pass our background check first. So this reverses the order that most California employers previously had used when utilizing criminal background checks. They would get an application, do the background check, and then decide whether or not to make an offer. This flips that equation on its head. Again, you need to, here in California, go through your job applications as well as the interviewing process and make sure we're not making impermissible inquiries about criminal background history prior to that conditional offer of employment being made.
Bruce, you really hit on two very hot issues, and let's tackle them one by one. First, with that salary history inquiry prohibition, these laws have been sprouting up in a number of places, not just California. We've seen them in Massachusetts, Delaware, and Oregon, with the goal, as you said, of stopping pay discrimination from perpetuating itself. So let me ask, why would an employer need that salary history information? Because after all, they're the ones in the best position to know what the job is worth.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of been a cult part of our culture in the American workplace is that the job application form includes a line that says, what are you currently making? And so putting yourself in the chair of the hiring manager, if you would, they've got six different applicants for a position. They're able to sort of tell by looking at the pay rate that each of these individuals is currently making, you know, they get sort of a sense for the applicant pool, if you would, and what kind of people are applying for these jobs. And if there's any obvious outliers, either making a lot more than what the employer thinks it might offer or a lot less, then that's going to display itself immediately. By taking that information away from the hiring manager, as you said, the focus really is on what's the actual market value of this job in our market today. The market value of a housekeeper may be different in the San Francisco Bay Area than it is out here in California's Central Valley. And the thinking is that compensation decisions should be driven by the market, not by past pay, which may or may not have been subject to various inequities.
Now, one provision of the California salary history law requires employers to provide pay scale information for a position upon a reasonable request. What do you think about that provision?
We've actually been getting a lot of questions from the business community about what does this mean, the pay scale? And unfortunately, all we have to go on are those two little words, pay scale. There's really no history that we can look to, and there's certainly no court decisions yet on our pay history inquiry ban law. So all we've got is those two words. You do need to provide the pay scale. Well, what is that? I've been advising my clients to do a couple of things. Number one, make sure you're consistent. Everybody involved in the onboarding and application and hiring process is giving the same information to all applicants for a particular position. So consistency is always important. Number two, I think you just have to take your best good faith estimate about what the market rate is for the position and put it out there. It can be one number, it can be a range of numbers, but you want to be extremely careful about what you put out there because this is now going to be potentially public information, and there's the specter of someone getting the information and then trotting down the street to a competitor and saying, hey, look, this is what they're paying over here. This is the information that I was provided. So it does change the equation and the dynamic a bit, and I think we're going to have to wait and let this one shake out a little bit to see what the potential issues and problems are.
Very interesting. Well, Bruce, let's turn back to that other new California law that you mentioned at the top that took effect January 1st, and that's the Ban the Box law. Nine other states have these measures affecting private employers, but your state's law goes pretty far in that it restricts criminal history questions until after a conditional job offer has been made, as you noted. So what does this mean as a practical matter for employers?
Well, the new law does, first of all, apply pretty much to every employer in the state. There is a small employer exception, but that's only for companies with four or fewer employees. And you basically just cannot ask these questions on an application or in an interview until the conditional offer of employment is made. So sequentially, here's how it works. The person comes in, they fill out their application form. You look at the form, it looks good. You make them an offer of employment. You say it's conditioned on their passing a background check. You conduct the background check, and let's say it comes back with some negative information that's a real concern to you. What do you do? Well, the law requires sort of a due process, if you would, for the job applicant at this point. You have to let them know what the results of the background check were. You have to sort of do an individualized assessment to consider how serious of a crime was this, how much time has passed since the unfortunate event took place, and what's the real nature of the job that is being applied for. So a conviction for assault might be a big concern if you're hiring somebody to go out to people's houses, but it might not be such a big concern if they're going to just come and work at a call center surrounded by 1,000 other employees. But then once an employer makes this preliminary decision that the conviction history might be disqualifying, you have to give written notice to the applicant identifying the disqualifying conviction, a copy of the history report, and then give them 5 days to respond and explain away, if you would, their situation. So not only does it impact the hiring process up front, it lingers throughout all the way to the final decision to hire or not hire.
Now, what about the fact that you have some big municipalities, most notably Los Angeles and San Francisco, that already had Ban the Box laws on the books, but those are not preempted by the new state law?
No, they're not. We've seen a trend across the country, and it's sort of this red state, blue city trend, if you would. There's a number of states in the country that statewide they sort of trend red, but then there's these urban areas which are sort of more progressive and more liberal. And there's been a little bit of a tug of war going back and forth. For example, in Arizona, the state has preempted the ability of cities to regulate the giving of toys as part of a meal, so your Happy Meal toy, if you would. Cities cannot regulate that, only the state can. But in California, we don't have that tug of war, and so the answer to the question which would apply if San Francisco has one ban the box law and the state has another ban the box law, the answer to that question in California is the employer needs to comply with both. And so basically, that law which affords the greatest protection to the employee must be complied with, because if you don't, then you're at risk of violating either the state or the municipal law.
Again, we're speaking with Littler Mendelson Management Side Employment Attorney Bruce Sarche, who's also a member of Littler's Workplace Policy Institute. And Bruce, shifting gears a little bit, 18 states had minimum wage increases take effect this January, and California is one of them. So tell us about that increase and how companies can also keep track of the many city minimum wage hikes that also took effect in the Golden State.
Sure thing, David. Our Workplace Policy Institute actually publishes a quarterly report. It's called the WPI Wage Watch. And if you just Google that, you'll get directed to it. We also have a weekly tracking service for which we do charge a fee, but that takes a look at state and major legislative developments, including minimum wage updates. So the ability to track these things is out there. But in terms of sort of the questions that people have been grappling with, one of them that I'm getting in California is from small businesses that hover between 25 and 26 employees. It's sort of a sleeper provision of the law, but California actually has a two-tiered minimum wage schedule right now. In California in 2018, if you have 25 or fewer employees, the minimum wage is $10.50 an hour. If you have 26 or more, it's $11 an hour. So two different minimum wages. And if you hover between 25 and 26, there are some pretty tricky questions that come up as to which minimum wage rate should apply and when should it apply. Our Division of Labor Standards Enforcement actually has published a FAQ sheet on this. You can find that online. Another sort of hidden impact of the minimum wage is that there are several components of California law which are tied to and driven by the minimum wage. The biggest example of this are the white-collar exemptions. Now, in order to be exempt from the payment of overtime in California under one of these administrative, executive, or professional exemptions, of course, an employee must meet three tests. They must do work of an exempt quality, they must do a sufficient quantity of that work, and they must be paid a minimum compensation level. The minimum compensation level is two times the minimum wage. So for 2018, if you've got 26 or more employees and you want to claim one of these exemptions in California, you've got to pay a salary of at least two times the minimum wage. That equates out to $45,760 a year. And as we know, the minimum wage is going to go up again in 2019 and in 2020 and so on, so that eventually the white-collar exemption minimum wage compensation component is going to get up to $62,400 in California. So these other things that are triggered by the minimum wage oftentimes escape our immediate attention, but they're sitting there and they have to be paid attention to as well.
And I would imagine it's a bit tricky out there, because where you are in Sacramento, the wage scale might be quite a bit different than, say, San Francisco or Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's a policy problem that we face here. New York State, for example, has different zones, and the state minimum wage in New York City is different from the state minimum wage in Albany. But not so in California. The state minimum wage in San Francisco is the same as in Sacramento, as the same in Visalia or Fresno or San Diego. I mean, these are quite different economies, really, in these different zones of California, which obviously is a large state. And there's just no deference paid to that at all. You've got to comply with the minimum wage just the same in Central Valley as you do in Los Angeles County.
Well, Bruce, another new law that recently took effect in California is the New Parent Leave Act, which applies to more employers than would be the case under the federal FMLA. So tell us how that came about, Bruce.
Sure thing, David. This is for smaller employers, and it does provide for additional leave of absence protections for employees in these small employer groups. So in California and under the federal family leave laws, of course, if you have 50 or more employees, you need to comply with FMLA. But now in California, if you have between 20 and 49 employees, you must also provide parental bonding leave. A lot of the provisions of this small employer parental bonding leave law track the FMLA. So eligibility for employees is triggered by 12 months of service and working at least 1,250 hours in the prior year, and that's the same as under the FMLA. You also need to work at a work location where 20 to 49 employees work within 75 miles of each other. That also tracks the FMLA. But unlike the FMLA, this applies only to parental bonding leave. It does not expand it out to illness of your spouse, illness of your parent, illness of your child, your own illness, etc., all of those other items which are covered by federal and state family and medical leave laws.
Well, certainly sexual harassment has been an issue very much in the news, and completely separate from all of those news events, California expanded its training requirements this year for supervisors to include education on gender identity and sexual orientation. What do you think will be the practical implications of those for employers?
Well, in California, we've been operating under the system of what we call AB 1825 training for nearly a decade now, might even be more than a decade. Every 2 years, supervisors need to get training on prohibited harassment. And again, this is for employers with 50 or more employees. The training has been expanded over the years, and as you mentioned, David, most recently to include training on transgender, gender identity, gender expression, and sexual orientation. So practically speaking, what's going to happen is that the courses are going to be modified and discussion of these topics will be included within the 2 hours required for supervisors every 2 years. But of import to everybody in California is a little law that was passed that impacts today only farm labor contractors in the state. And today in California, training similar to the supervisor training must be provided to all employees of farm labor contractors, not just supervisors. It's my opinion that with all of the attention that recently our society has been focusing on sexual harassment and sexual misconduct, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see this requirement expanded in California out to all employees. In other words, all employees are going to be required to receive training on sexual harassment in the workplace. That's a prediction. It's not the law today. Only supervisors or employees of farm labor contractors need be subject to this training. I don't think it's going to be too long before the law is broadened out to require training for all employees.
Well, that will certainly be something to watch. And speaking of predictions, you've got your ear to the ground there in Sacramento, Bruce. So I'll ask you to look into the crystal ball a little bit and talk about what's percolating in the legislature that employers should be on the lookout for in the coming year in California.
Well, one thing that we haven't talked about is the explosion in California of private attorney general act claims. These are claims where the law allows a worker to step into the shoes of the attorney general and bring a claim on behalf of him or herself and all other similarly situated employees. There's been a real growth in these sorts of claims, and there's some pushback from the business community, and there's a couple of bills pending in the assembly which would limit this sort of extremely broad current scope of these private attorney general act claims. There's a couple of business and industry groups that have been formed that are behind this. Your listeners might want to look up the California Business and Industry Alliance. This group was formed specifically to take on PAGA, Private Attorney General Act reform. So I think we're going to see some activity in that area. Perhaps a contraction of these kind of lawsuits that really are a bit out of control in the state today. On the other side, expansion, I think we may see a rebirth in predictive scheduling laws, which was a topic of our podcast last summer between the two of us there, David. I think at a state level in California, we may see this come up again, where the thinking is that employees should have some sort of ability to know what their work schedule is in advance, and if there's a change, then the employer might have to pay some sort of penalty to the employee for changing a schedule at the last minute. We've seen these laws on a municipal level. We may see them at the state level as well.
Okay. Well, Bruce, before we let you go, is there any final thought that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I would be remiss if I don't say my usual thing when I'm departing from a group of businesses and employers in California, and that is that compliance is difficult, it is challenging, it is tricky, and you should definitely focus on that as part of your business plan, but also just making sure your workplace culture is a good one, that you have good supervisors that are really listening to your employees, that are good communicators, that understand why the business does what it does and is able to communicate that to employees. It doesn't play favorites, they're consistent. If you have good supervisors and a good workplace, a lot of times employees will say, this is a good place to work, and they just do their job and go home at the end of the day and they're with their families, and they don't bring up these compliance challenges. So that's sort of always my parting message here to those of us in the employer community. Compliance is important, but having a good workplace culture is almost equally as important.
Okay, well, let that be the last word. Bruce Sarchet practices with Littler Mendelson's Sacramento office, where he's a shareholder representing employers, and he's also a member of the firm's Workplace Policy Institute. Bruce, thanks so much for your insights.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Continue checking our website regularly for more programs on key employment-related issues, including our recent two-part podcast series you won't want to miss on superstar sexual harassment. The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR, our subscription offering, or our 50-state employee handbook, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Copyright 2018, all rights reserved.